My pleasure to introduce Michael Brenner. Michael is from Harvard University. He got his PhD from Chicago, working with Leo Kaminoff. And at some point or other, he touched up at MIT. And about 5 years ago, he moved up Massachusetts Avenue to Harvard. And today, he thinks about many things. And today, he's going to think about evolution.
So thank you, Steve. So, and thank you all for having me. I might set the record for the number of people who... No, you're not supposed to clap. Jesus. I'm going to try to set the record today for the number of people who run screaming from a talk in its early stages. That's a joke. Okay, so I'm going to... This talk is a little bit funny. I hope it works, given the number of people that are here. It's a talk more about what I would like to be thinking about than what I'm actually thinking about. So the talk is going to be more or less a complaint. And hopefully it's a sustained and coherent complaint. And so let me first tell you what I mean by evolution, or I think evolution means. So, so basically there are phenotypes of organisms, and those phenotypes are supposed to be determined by sets of genes. And genes, of course, are composed of amino acids. And amino acids can be mutated through time, through various processes, which leads to evolution. And so the normal sort of, the most successful way of thinking about evolution that I'm aware of is captured by the subject of population genetics, in which one makes models derived from experimental data of the rates at which amino acids change. And over time, they lead to changes in the genes, which are supposed to lead to changes in the phenotypes, which are supposed to lead to evolution. And this is a very interesting subject, and it's, if you want to work on evolution, then at least my advice would be at least from what I'm aware of, you're most likely to succeed if you follow that approach. But the problem that I guess I've always had with this is that there's sort of no physics in it, in a certain way. And what I mean by that is that you don't actually learn what actually is happening. It doesn't really tell you what actually happened. I mean, what happened is a rich process which occurred because of changes in the environment of the Earth, changes in nutrient concentrations of various things. I don't really know exactly what the question is, which is the reason for my sustained complaint that you will have to listen to now. But that's basically what I've been trying to think about. And I thought that the easiest way to introduce this topic, there are actually many ways of introducing this topic, but the way I'm going to introduce this topic is to tell you about a paper that we just finished last week, which is about whales. It doesn't really have anything to do with evolution, but the second part of the talk. In the second part of the talk, I'm going to get more at the research program that we're really trying to construct to figure out how to think about this. But anyway, okay, so whales. So let me start. So these are pictures of whales. So this is a finback whale, and this is a blue whale, and an arctic whale, and a killer whale. And you'll notice that the whales have flippers on them. So I want you to just focus on the shape of the flippers. These flippers, right, have the shapes that they do. So these are whales. And so now let me show you a picture of a humpback whale. Uh-oh. Oh, there's the humpback whale. That's the one that was on the thing. So here's a humpback whale. So these are the flippers on a humpback whale. And you'll notice that the flippers on the humpback whale, compared to the other whales that you've seen, are, first of all, much longer. It's a much longer flipper relative to the size of the body of the whale. And also, there are these bumps on the flipper. And so the question is, why are there long and bumpy flippers? Now, that's a dangerous question to ask. So it turns out that there's also, if you read the literature, there's another sort of anecdotal statement about whales that I don't really know what to make up, but I'll just tell it to you. The anecdotal statement is that humpback whales are the most acrobatic of whales. I copied the word acrobatic from a paper. And I don't know what that means or how you measure acrobaticity, but anyway, that's the statement. So there's this person, a biologist at Westchester University, who's aptly named Frank Fish, who hypothesized, this is true, he's around, he's an excellent scientist, he writes really very good papers, who hypothesized that, in fact, these two facts are related, namely the hydrodynamic maneuverability of the whale, the fact that it's more acrobatic, and the funny shape of the flipper. So this is something that you can, in principle, test. You can test experimentally. And to do this, what he did was to encourage colleagues at the U.S. Naval Academy to produce two flippers, one of which had a smooth shape, and the other of which had a bumpy shape. And the flippers were designed to have the same area, so that the area at which hydrodynamic forces acted on them was the same in two cases. And what he did was he put it in a wind tunnel and he measured the aerodynamic characteristics. And what he learned from this is that, in fact, if you measure, when an airplane takes off, there's a critical angle at which you lose lift. And so this is a plot of what is called the lift coefficient. which is essentially proportional to the lift, as a function of the angle of attack, which is that the angle that the flipper makes with the flow head-on, with the bumps head-on to the flow, as a function of the angle. And what you see, this red line is what happens for the smooth flipper, and the blue dots are for the bumpy flipper. And what you see is that the bumpy flipper is able to, according to these experiments anyway, maintain lift up to a higher angle than a smooth flipper. So these experiments were then reproduced by another group who reached the same conclusion. The other group tried different wavelengths of the bumps and found that they didn't matter very much. And so the question is, and so this seems to indicate that there may be a connection between these two features. And so the question, that this is the topic of our paper that I'm just going to tell you two slides about, is, but why? I mean, what is the hydrodynamic mechanism for this observed fact? I'm not sure if it's a fact, actually. It's an experiment. It may not be a fact. But this observation that the stall angle apparently depends on the shape of the wing. And this second thing is sort of starts to get to evolution, although I'll comment on it in a minute, is that if you believe this, which I'm not saying that I do, nor am I trying to convince you to, I'm just telling you a story, is that you might be interested in the optimal shape of the bumps to sustain this mechanism, because you might imagine that, well, maybe the shapes of the bumps will become optimized so that it can have the largest angle of attack that it can before it stalls. I don't know. So anyway, okay, so what we did, and this is two slides of equations. I think there aren't very many equations in this talk, but the density of equations here is rather high on this slide, is that basically what we did was to make a simple aerodynamic model of this, and essentially use aerodynamics from the 1930s, essentially, to try to study this. It's sort of surprising that this problem hadn't been studied before, namely to study whether bumpy flippers can enhance enhanced lift. But basically, the way that we did this was to imagine that the wing was essentially locally a two-dimensional wing, but that the chord length, so this is the chord length, changed slowly as you move along the wing. And the consequence of this is you can think of this as being a sequence of two-dimensional aerodynamic problems. And whether you know anything about aerodynamics or not, it doesn't really matter. You can at least imagine that mankind understands how to solve 2D aerodynamics problems, because airplanes fly, after all, and they have basically wings which are basically just flat. I mean, if you've ever sat on the wing, you can see. So we know how to do that. And so basically, so this allows you to really write down, to do a calculation, to study this with equations, and I don't really want to dwell on these, it doesn't really matter. I mean, you can calculate the lift force as a function of things. And there's certain interesting hydrodynamics which comes from what is called lifting line theory, which is the input, which I'll just tell those of you who care about this, I will tell. But if you don't, just don't listen for a minute. Or this could be a mechanism to cause some of you to leave. Which is that basically there's a fact of aerodynamics that was discovered by Joukowsky, Kata and Joukowsky, which is that what is called the circulation, which is basically the amount of rotational flow about a wing, is proportional to the chord length of the wing. And when you change the chord length of the wing as you move along it, then what that does is it causes different amounts of rotation. But there's a conservation law which says that basically that angular momentum is conserved, which says that if you do that, you must create an additional component to the flow, which then thereby locally modifies the angle of attack. And one can basically write down a pretty much closed-form model to do this, which we did. From that, you can calculate the pressure distribution over the wing. And from that, you can calculate, without dwelling on it, more or less quasi-analytically, I guess is the way I would say this, a theoretical curve for the lifting coefficient as a function of the angle of attack. And this is the theoretical curve. So eta is the amplitude of the bumps. And what you should notice here is that eta equals 0, stall happens abruptly, and when you increase eta, then the stall angle goes out, becomes bigger, and I think I just broke this pointer. I don't know. Yeah, that would be great, actually. I hope I don't break yours too. Thank you. Oh, it's red. Bottom button. Okay, thank you. So as eta increases, the angle at which it stalls gets bigger. And the nice thing about this calculation, the reason that we wrote a paper about this, is because from it you could actually figure out what the physical mechanism was for the effect. And the physical mechanism is actually that it turns out that stall happens first along the troughs, because the adverse pressure gradient is higher there. And what that means is that the bumps essentially average out the regional along the wing where stall happens. Instead of it happening simultaneously over the whole wing, it happens locally. And the consequence of that is that you have this effect. Okay, so if you didn't care about the last three slides, that's okay. It doesn't matter. I now want to get this. So now the question is, let's get back to evolution. So is there, okay, so fine. So there is this effect, which incidentally an interesting thing, which I think people are starting to do, and I hope people do, is to try to put bumpy wings on model airplanes. To my knowledge, it hasn't been tried, actually. But it's a, But it should, as an aerodynamic mechanism, it's an interesting one, and just shows that you can learn a little bit about technology from biology in principle by just looking. But anyway, so you can ask, well, how big should the bumps be? And this eta here is basically this pointer isn't working so well either, but okay. So this eta is, I hope I didn't break it. So this eta is basically the amplitude of the bumps relative to the chord, and if you go back to the last calculation, then what you see is that the effect sets in at around eta equals 0.02, and if you then go and you measure the humpback whale flippers, as Frank Fish has done extensively, you find out that humpbacks have an eta which is about 0.06, which you can extract from this figure. And also, in our calculations, as there are in experiments, there's not a strong wavelength dependence, so one doesn't expect that one would select the wavelength. Okay, so you could, from this, declare great success and say, well, isn't this fantastic? So we've learned, you see, about why there are bumpy flippers, because we have this aerodynamic mechanism, there are experiments, we have, the numbers are at least sort of like the flipper, and so maybe everything is all well and good, except that there's one small problem. What about the other whales? You see, the other whales don't have bumpy flippers. And so you may say, that's because they're not acrobatic. But why aren't they acrobatic? Maybe it's that they can't develop bumpy flippers. Maybe bumpy flippers have nothing to do with the aerobaticity of whales. Maybe all of this, this could be a perfectly good fluid mechanical calculation, which I submit to you that it is, and it could have nothing to do with whales, per se. And or said differently, this is a just-so story. It's fairly typical of such stories in biology. And I guess I would assert that, if you read the literature, dating back as long as you'd like to look, there's really a long and rich intellectual history of such arguments. Such arguments are always publishable. Actually, we don't yet know if this argument is publishable, but we're trying. But they're always publishable, and the reason they're always publishable is because it's not wrong. You don't know if it's right. It seems interesting. But the point is that they never actually make an impact on the subject, because no one knows what to do about them. So I guess I would claim that we're in good company, and just to demonstrate that to you, let me just tell you another one. So von Karman, who is a great fluid mechanician, once made the following argument about Atlantic mackerel. It's the same type of argument that we made, which is that Atlantic mackerel, you see, have a shape that looks like this. And he said, oh, gee, that reminds me of the shape of an airfoil. So he took an Atlantic mackerel, and he took its shape, and he put it on top of the shape of an airfoil, and it was nicely tapered and everything. And so he said, so you see, that's why Atlantic mackerel look like this. Except the problem with that, of course, is that if you have young children, or even if you like watching such movies, that's Nemo. And Nemo does not look like an Atlantic mackerel. So why is this true? Why does he choose Atlantic mackerel? Well, the reason is because Atlantic mackerel were the only fish that had this property. So, and I guess what I would submit is what's infuriating about these types of arguments is that you want it to be true, but how do you make this into a subject that's actually science or physics or whatever you want to call it, and not just, thing. And so I would assert that if it were true, and you knew it were true, then you at least are obliged to explain how accurate the tuning needs to be. You need to be able to explain why some fish have this feature and some don't, and et cetera, et cetera. And this is what we, the sort of thing that I guess we've been struggling with for a long time, and I think this might summarize what I've said. So remarks. So my first remark is that what I'm describing to you, of course, is not 20th century, or it's not 21st century, and it's really only, it's not certainly not late 20th century biology. This is 19th century biology. This is go out and look at features and see what they look like. So to really study this model, to really study a problem like this, one needs to incorporate, at least you have to admit to be intellectually honest, late 20th century biology, and try to connect the structures that form to actual developmental mechanisms. And there are a host of questions that one can ask, none of which I know the answer to. So are possible shapes that can be created of anything constrained by development? I have no idea. To my knowledge, no one knows this, although things are starting to be understood. For the case of the whales, are there selective pressures on maneuverability? This has to do with the psychology of the whales and the environment that they live in. And so clearly, as I say at the bottom, if you're interested in studying these sorts of questions, which I am, although it makes me a little nervous, then whales and fishes are not the best place to study this problem. And so for that reason, we've been trying to think of other ways to study the problem, and that's what I want to talk about today. But before I do that, I just want to take two slides and just remark on the modern picture of evolution and how it may... how it may impact this. So basically, I said this at the very beginning. So basically, models of evolution, and I mean both mathematical models and just thinking models, imagine that every individual reproduces at some rate, and that rate that it reproduces is a function of its genotype. Mutation changes the individual rates, which thus leads to competition and change in the distribution of individuals, and thus change, you know, leads to changes in things like the shapes of flippers and whatnot. Okay, so this is a list of, and I think this is a little bit repetitive, but some questions about evolution. So how are novel features evolved? You know, I mean, so there are individual sequence changes. That's fine. It may be a little more complicated than that, but, you know, can one outline a plausible sequence of events that with timescales attached to them that lead to the evolution of an actually complicated thing? So, I mean, you know, there are arguments about the evolution of the eye, for example, and how that came about. And I think that as a physical problem, or not as a physical problem, as a problem, I think it's interesting to think about this. What is the rate of evolving novel features? Is there tuning? What is the dependence on environment, et cetera? These are the sorts of issues that one would like to be able to think about in a scientific way. Okay. So, so clearly, in order to do this, one needs better examples to be able to make progress. And I don't claim that the examples I'm going to talk about, and they will not make progress at these big, grandiose questions that I just asked, but we're trying, and if nothing else, I would ask for feedback or what else to do. So the work that I just told you about whales was done by a graduate student, Ernst von Nierop, and a terrific postdoc named Silas Albin. So what I want to do for the rest of the talk, well, actually, first let me say, so there are sort of three other arenas that we've been thinking about these questions in. One, and that's what we will spend the rest of the time discussing. The first is the shape of fungal spores, which is sort of a macroscopic physiology question, just like fishes and whales, but it has the feature that it may be simple enough that one could start to get at the developmental questions that I asked, although in no way will this talk do that. This talk will simply set up the problem. And then I'm going to spend most of my time, in the remainder of the talk, talking about one of two examples which are molecular. So the advantage of molecular examples is that if you actually study the evolution of a protein, which is composed of amino acids, which itself has some physiology associated with it, then there's a more direct link between genotype and phenotype. And the notion is that it may be easier to try to put together these sorts of arguments. And so what I'm going to spend most of my time in this talk talking about, and this is when people will probably really start running out of the room, is talking about the evolution of voltage-gated ion channels, or at least our efforts to start to study them. And this is work that was done mainly by Elaine Angelino when she was an undergraduate. Then at the end, if I have time, I might say something about hemoglobin, which I think is another example. But that's my talk. And I should also say, this doesn't feel like a very informal occasion, but if you want to interrupt me, please do. I don't need to get to the end of this talk. And I I don't make any pretension to being clear. Okay, so this is a break. So I'm now going to switch topics. So comments? Anybody else? Question? No. No one has anything to say. That's good. Okay. This talk is going well. Okay. So let me talk about fungal spores. Okay. So this is sort of our modern day version of von Karman. So these are fungal spores. So fungi reproduce by basically shooting out spores in the environment, which when they become hydrated, they produce more fungi. And there's a class of spores which are ejected explosively. That is, they come off of the fungus at meters per second and are ejected into the air. And those spores, and this is a picture of the shapes of two types of spores, of this Neurospora crassa and another one whose name I can't pronounce as well, N-tetrasperma. And the curves on top of it are shapes of the spores that were predicted by some model. And I want to tell you about the model just very briefly and try to argue why this might be an interesting problem to study the biology of, and that's what we're starting to try to do. So these spores tend to be created by species of fungus that reproduce in the following way. Cows, they live on grass, for example. Cows eat the grass, and they then come out in the cow dung. And it turns out that cows and other animals don't like to eat near their dung. And in fact, there's what is called in the literature a zone of repugnance surrounding the grazing matter. So these spores, in order to continue their life cycle, must be ejected and must make it far away from the dung that the cows will eat the grass where the dung is. Otherwise, they can't reproduce. And so for reasons that you can imagine, it has been argued, and I think the arguments are actually well, they may be wrong, but they're not bad arguments, that the distance that they move depends strongly on the fluid drag, and hence there's been an idea in the literature that really is, I guess I would credit to Vogel, that the drag minimization could contribute substantially to the shape. So for those of you who are interested in fluid mechanics, this is the last fluid mechanical example in this talk. So the Reynolds number of the flow, so it turns out these spores are ejected at speeds of order a meter per second, and if you calculate the Reynolds number, given that they're sort of 10 microns-ish big, the Reynolds number is of order 1 to 10. And so the question is what is the shape of bodies which optimize drag at Reynolds number of that sort? For some reason, these shapes, we couldn't find in the literature that these shapes were ever calculated before, probably because why would you do such a thing? And so we calculated them, and this is what they look like. And I just want to notice, and I want you to notice, these are different shapes at different Reynolds numbers. This is Reynolds numbers 0.1, 5, 25, and 100. And what you should notice about this is that the aspect ratio of the shape increases with Reynolds number, and Reynolds number you can think of as being a surrogate for size. And so the question that we asked ourselves is, before going out and investing a study in the developmental biology of these things, can you make an argument that, I mean, you know, this is now subject to the previous arguments that I made. I mean, we've shown you exactly the spore shapes such that the pictures agree. So what we did is, it turned out we were very lucky, and across the street from us there's a organismal biology department in which we met a wonderful mycologist named Ann Pringle. So a mycologist is a person who studies fungi. And Ann got interested in this and helped us do the following thing. We took all known ejected fungal spores. So we took family trees of fungi that look like this, and Ann helped us go through it for every single one and figure out which spores were ejected or not. And then it turned out that, and we were very lucky in this was totally random, that Harvard, it turns out, has a very good fungus library. It's very strange. But the fungus library, if you ever happen to get interested in anything having to do with fungi, it's open from 10 till 12 every morning. And it turns out that in the 19th century, which is mainly when this library was put together, the mycologists, people who study fungi, made very accurate drawings of various species of fungi. There's also an interesting fact, which is that most known fungi live in New England. It's just an interesting fact. But anyway, so what Marcus did. So Marcus Roper, who was the graduate student who did this, he spent every morning this summer in July and August between 10 till 12 in the morning in the fungus library making measurements of the shapes of the different fungal spores, which we were assured were quantitatively accurate. And what we wanted to do was to see if the aspect ratio dependence on size had any bearing in the data. We excluded fungi according to a set of criteria that were basically given to us a priori by our friend. And this is the result. And I don't want to claim this is good or bad. I just want to show it to you as it is. So this is a plot of aspect ratio as a function of spore size. Every dot corresponds to a different species of fungi. The error bars refer to the fact that each of these species tends to have on the order of 10 to 30 different spore shapes. And Marcus went and measured every one. This was very painful for all of the species that were known to have explosively ejected spores. And this, the solid line actually is the prediction of the aspect ratio as a function of spore size. the solid line in the center, the light solid lines that are around it correspond to within 1% of the optimum drag, and within 5%, the other lines are within 5% of the optimum drag, and that's the situation. And it's a bit of a mess, actually. But there is this trend, and there may be something to this. I present this to you just because I'm not sure what to say about this other than what I've said, but I think this expresses to me very clearly the situation that we find ourselves in, if you want to think this way, which it may be arguing against. Okay, good. So now, this is a very good introduction to why, I mean, there could be lots of reasons, of course, I should say, why these things are so scattered, not the least of which is that the environmental conditions under which these different species developed, even if they were all in New England, I don't know if any of you have spent time in New England, but their different parts have different characteristics. I mean, if you're on the top of the mountain, it's different than if you're in the basin. And we don't know, of course, the environmental history of how these things came about. So the scatter isn't necessarily a worry, but it certainly doesn't make you, and I think Marcus would argue that this is pretty good, and also Ann would argue this too, and I don't disagree with this, but on the other hand, it's not the data that this colloquium is presumably used to. Okay, so hence, the question is, can one make these sorts of arguments? And so we started thinking about molecular systems in which there is something known about physiology. And I now, and of course, the advantage here, as I already said, is that the connection between genotype and phenotype is much more direct. And so now let me do this by talking about ion channels. And actually, this slide isn't supposed to do that. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what ion channels are, and I'm going to try to convince you that the study of the evolution of voltage-gated ion channels might not be a bad idea, and then I'll show you some results which are going in that direction. So what are voltage-gated ion channels? So voltage-gated ion channels are membrane proteins. So they're basically holes in membranes that live in lipid membranes that regulate the flow of ions from the inside of the cell to the outside of the cell. Now, what ions are we talking about? Well, the primary ions, at least that are positively charged, which are the only ones I'm going to be talking about here today, although one could in principle talk about others, that are in the cells are sodium, potassium, and calcium. And these ion channels have the remarkable feature they're little holes that let through sodium but not potassium, or potassium but not sodium. Which, if you think about it from the point of view of physics, is really quite remarkable, because they're ionic spheres. I mean, they're spheres with almost the same ionic radius. And how does it do that? That's an interesting question. But anyway, and the permeability of these holes, that is, whether how they open or close, it happens in a voltage-dependent way, because there are voltages across the membrane. Now, it turns out that sodium channels, potassium channels, and calcium channels are widespread in biology, and for the most part, the voltage-gated ones have a common evolutionary history. That is, if you make evolutionary trees of the protein sequences, you can trace them back to bacteria. It's currently believed that there are primordial potassium channels that exist in bacteria. The functions of the three are, at least in broad brush, rather common. These ion channels represent the molecular basis of the nervous system, and the question of how do ion channels evolve is not unrelated to the question of how did the nervous system evolve. But there is tremendous functional diversity in these channels, as I will. And what I'm going to spend all of my time discussing is the evolution of voltage-gated sodium channels, but then it's going to become even more specific, and I'm going to talk about the voltage-gated sodium channels that exist in all of you. That's where I'm going to end. So the thing that's really great about this is, which I just want to point out, and I'm not going to explain this in any detail, but I just want to point out why I think this is great, is that this is a picture of the protein. It's a certain representation of a voltage-gated any of these channels. And so this is the amino acid sequence, and this is the protein as it lives embedded in the membrane. And what's great about this is that you notice that there are these little words that are connected to arrows. So, like, there's a word here called inactivation. Inactivation is something that I'll tell you about in a moment, but it's pointing in this picture to a very specific part of the sequence. And this is because the study of this is so advanced that it is known which part of the sequence is responsible for each function. Now, of course, I'm overstating things quite a lot, actually. It's complicated, and it's also well known to be rather complicated, but the opinions are strong enough, there's enough information to know that at least that part of the sequence is responsible for this functional property, although it's also known that it's more complicated than that. But if you compare this to the other questions that I've been asking, this is really much better. Even with the uncertainty, which is significant that exists, this is much better. Okay, so in human beings, there are 143 different voltage-gated ion channels. This statement is based on a recent study of Bill Catterall from the University of Washington. And this is an evolutionary tree, just to sort of show you about this. It turns out there are 10 voltage-gated sodium channels. These are called NaV 1.1 to 1.9, and then there's X. They're sort of badly named, but Na is sodium, V is voltage. And the one is because there's always the thought there might be more families, and the second number labels the number. There are also, similarly, some number of voltage-gated calcium channels. And this is an evolutionary tree of these channels that is based on sequence changes. So what does that mean? The way you make the tree is the following. You take the sequence of two of the channels, you line them up against each other, and there's a well-developed technology to do this, and then you just count the number of changes between the two sequences. You take the two that are closest, you put them next to each other on the tree, you then add the next ones on, et cetera, et cetera. And the scale of this, just so you know how similar these are, I think this is really interesting, that line corresponds to 20 changes. And these proteins are about 2,000 amino acids long, so this is not a lot of change. But nonetheless, there's a lot of heterogeneity. Okay, and the question, what we thought was, and I don't know if this was a good thought or a bad thought, but this is what we thought, is that if you're interested in studying the types of questions that I've been talking about, you sort of have two choices. You can either study things which are very different, or you can study things that are nearly identical. And very different, this is very complicated. Very different seems hard. So we just chose to study things that are nearly identical, reasoning that if we couldn't even figure this out, then we would have a problem. And as I said, what I'm going to focus on today is purely the question of our sodium channels. And I'm going to show you sort of what I would argue the beginnings of results, although, as in this entire talk, well, I told you at the beginning, trying to convince you all that you should leave now, that this talk has more questions than answers. There will be more questions than answers. But I hope to at least convince you that this is not a crazy thing to spend your time doing. Although if you're not convinced, you should tell me, because there are lots of things one could work on and start working on something else. Questions. So this is a list of questions. So from this, you could ask, why are there so many identical sodium channels? I mean, isn't this crazy? I mean, you know, there are only 20,000 genes in the human genome. This is the current, the latest estimate is on the order of 20,000. Why would there be 10 things which are almost the same? I mean, 20,000 doesn't sound like a lot. I don't even know what to say about these numbers. It doesn't make any sense to me. This is sort of related to my comment about there not being any physics in this at the beginning. Okay, so why are the channels different from each other? So that's what I'm basically going to focus on today, is trying to answer just that little question, just a little tiny question. So the second question is, how did they become different? That's an interesting question. That has to do with evolution. And then the most interesting thing, which is the reason I think this really is sort of could be a promising direction if one could pull it off, is that there's the broader history dependence of all of these channels with respect to each other. And since these channels do things, then that might be a broader thing. Okay, so let me just make one other. I'm going to show you one more evolutionary tree, and I want to make a remark. So this is an evolutionary tree which is similar to the one that I showed you before, except it has two differences. First of all, it has many more animals other than humans. The R in front of the NAs and refers to rat. There are mouses on this. And then the different colors other than blues refer to different species. So, for example, DM is Drosophila down there, which is a type of fly. There are electric fishes in green up there. There are lots of different organisms, all of which have sodium channels. And the point that I want to make from this slide is the following. If you look at the sodium channel, if you look at the rat has a sodium channel which is closer. If you take one of the rat sodium channels, rats also have 10. If you take one of it and you ask which sodium channel in the rat is closest, you take the one of ours that's closest, it's closer to a certain one of ours than it is to all the others, which argues for some sort of stability. It's not that these 20 changes are just flipping around randomly. So a better argument in this direction is the following fact. This is a table from a paper which shows where the different sodium channels are expressed. And so what it turns out is that different sodium channel types are expressed in different tissues. And so, for example, CNS and PNS here refer to the nervous system, the central and peripheral nervous system. And many of the sodium channels, 1.1, 1.2, 1.3, are expressed in the nervous system. NAD1.4 is expressed in skeletal muscular junctions. 1.5 is expressed in the heart. 1.6, 1.7, the others are also all expressed in the nervous system. And the fact of the matter is if you look at our cardiac sodium channel, that is the sodium channel that exists in your heart, and you then look at the rat's sodium channels and you ask which sodium channel in rats is closest to yours in your heart, it turns out it's the one that's also in the rat's heart, which is arguing for something which is sort of related to what I was saying in the beginning of the talk, which is that there's some sort of tuning which depends on environment. And indeed, one of the nice things about this topic, the physics of this topic, is actually very well developed and has been going on, you know, for more than 50 years since the work of Hodgkin and Huxley, who really figured this out. And that is that that sodium channels, all of these voltage-gated ion channels, are really mainly responsible for producing action potentials. So, for example, the neuronal sodium channels, the ones that are expressed in various parts of the nervous system, are produce neuronal action potentials, whereas the cardiac ones produce cardiac action potentials. And these are essentially measuring voltage as a function of time across the membrane in both nerve cells and cardiac cells. And what you should notice from this picture is that the two shapes look very different. So that is, the shape of the typical voltage swing that happens in nerves looks like this, and in cardiac channels it looks like that. The sodium channels are associated with the onset, and the onset time in both is about the same. But the fact is that in your heart, or actually in any muscle, when the sodium channel is open, what happens is that calcium comes running in, which triggers muscle contraction. And this is just a very different functional, it's a very different function, and there are very different constraints than you would imagine that there were in the brain. Now, this, of course, is a just-so story. I don't dispute this. What I'm arguing is a just-so story. But the nice thing about this just-so story is it's one that can be backed up by numbers and analysis and sequence, and that's really the hope of this research endeavor. So, okay, I'm going to ignore that. So what I'm going to do, and I have, I think, 10 minutes, right? Where did Steve go? 15 minutes. I have 10 minutes. Is that I'm going to tell you probably more than you want to know about ion channels, about how ion channels work. And then I'm going to tell you two results, what I think are results about this. And the results are going to be, what I'm going to argue, the results are going to have to do with the constraints that are that exist on voltage-gated sodium channels, and also some indications into why there's so much diversity. So I'm going to not explain all the diversity, but I think we'll present actual physical arguments that relate to some of them. And then I'll tell you why this might be a benchmark for asking more questions. Okay. So first of all, let me tell you a little bit about ion channels. So the way that ion channels work, as I already said, is that they're a hole in the membrane, which can either open or close. Now, it turns out that in cells, the sodium concentration outside of cells is higher than that inside of cells. And the consequence of that is that a sodium molecule will, in the outside, will diffuse across the hole to the inside. But when it does that, there is an electrical imbalance because sodium has charge in it. And so there's therefore an electrical force which tends to push it in the opposite direction. And when enough sodium goes across the membrane, these two forces balance, and there's no flux of charge across the membrane, at which time there is a potential difference across the membrane, which is set up in equilibrium. And that potential difference is given by this formula. This formula is basically just the inverse of the Boltzmann formula, and it says that the potential across the membrane is equal to kT over E times the log of the concentration ratio. And this number, kT over E, if you evaluate it, is 25 millivolts, which is the scale of the problem. Now, if the potential difference across the membrane is not equal to this number, then, of course, there's a current, and that current is the source of the propagation of action potentials. So now, just for numbers, these numbers, VNA, which is the equilibrium potential of sodium, and VK, which is the equilibrium potential of potassium, are essentially fixed by the concentrations of ions that there are inside and outside the cell. These are non-negotiable numbers. Now, basically, the deal is that if the potential difference across the membrane is not equal to the equilibrium potential, then there's a current that goes through the hole. And this current, the formula, the amount of current that goes is given by Ohm's law. This is Ohm's law, where we just take into account the fact that there's an equilibrium value where nothing goes through. So the thing that we're talking about the evolution of, just so that you understand exactly what we mean, is that it turns out that these holes can open and close. So the conductivity of the system can, as it were, depends on voltage and thus can change in time. And when I tell you that you have 9 different or 10 different voltage-gated sodium channels, what I'm telling you is that you have 10 different little things in your body which have the feature that they open and close in very slightly different ways in accordance to this. And the question really is why and how, you know, from the point of view of, I don't know how to say this, from dynamical systems maybe, how do these, what's the reason for the evolution of these guys? Okay, so there's a little picture that goes along with them opening and closing that I need to tell you in order to explain the rest of this talk to you, which is that it turns out that there are two ways that ion channels can open and close. One is that they can be closed, and that happens when the potential difference across the membrane is very negative, so there's more negative charge on the inside than on the outside. When you make the potential difference very positive, then the hole starts to open, but in equilibrium, it turns out there's a little ball that's hanging into the cytoplasm. And when it gets very positive, the ball blocks the hole, even though the hole remains open. And this is called inactivation. And so it's sort of a complicated hole. It's got hinges and balls. But this sort of picture model has been studied for 50 years and is not perfect, but it's not a bad representation of the data. And it at least gives you, I mean, what you'd really like to know, and if I, nothing else, communicate nothing else I want today, I want to communicate questions. What you'd really like to know is the evolution of little pictures like that. That's what you want to know, right? But that's hard. But at least in this case, these are actually little mechanisms that one can presumably study, in which the time constants for various things have slightly different numbers, and the question is, why would that happen? Okay, so now let's see. I don't want to bore you with too many details, but I probably should at least mention the next two. Which is that, so there's a standard experiment that people do, which people have done for 50 years to measure the way that these holes open. And the experiment goes like this. You start out with a voltage which is very negative, so your hole is closed. And then what you do is you step to a higher voltage where in equilibrium the holes will be blocked. And you then measure the current that goes across the holes as a function of time, which you can measure, which basically is measuring the fraction of holes that are open as a function of time. And you tend to get a curve like this. They open, and then they close. And so this curve has data on it. The data that's on this curve, this has numbers on it. For the particular voltage, you can measure the time that it takes to open, how much it opens, and the time that it takes for it to close. And there's another measurement that people tend to make. And actually, if you take this data and you organize it, so if you, for example, measured the maximum probability of the hole opening as a function of the voltage step, then you can get a curve which characterizes the entire channel, which people call the inactivation curve. And you can do the same thing, it turns out, for the fraction of holes that are blocked in equilibrium, and that's called the inactivation curve. So there are various data of this sort that can be measured. Now, the fact of the matter is, so the question is that this is sort of like, so I apologize for the last slide. I have a feeling it made no sense, but I was trying to, I'm not sure what I was trying to do. Okay, so, but the point that I'm trying to make is there are physiological properties of the holes which is sort of analogous to the fluid mechanics at the beginning of the talk, which is what I just said. And if you measure the kinetics of different holes, of this is 1.4, which is expressed in muscle, and this is the second one is expressed in the brain, the different holes have slightly different kinetic properties. And there are tons and tons of papers in the literature which have plots like this. So you see these curves in the top are exactly like the one I just showed you. You do this little experiment, and then you just watch how these curves change with voltage. And if you look at the numbers for the different channels, they have slight differences in the way that they work. And so the question is to really understand that. So basically what we did, and I now am on my last 9 minutes, which is perfect because that's exactly the amount of detail that you might be able to stand for 9 minutes. So what we did basically is to first of all make an enormous catalog, the biggest catalog that we could of ion channel properties. So what we did is we took all 10 mammalian voltage-gated sodium channels, and we basically wanted to catalog all curves that looked like this and map out the space of possible properties that occur. So this is analogous to, in the whale flipper case, going out and finding all humpback whales and taking all distributions of the shapes of the whale's fins. But this is much more precise because this is the properties of a molecule. We then, and this was done, and the reason that there are a lot of papers, there are really a lot of papers, and the reason is that the papers all sort of look like this. They have titles like this. Voltage sensor sodium channel mutations cause paralysis by enhanced activation and reduced current. And what this was a paper about was a mutation in a sodium channel, one of the ones that I was talking about, in which the mutation caused paralysis, and the authors demonstrated that if you measured its properties using the experiment that I just described, that it had slightly different properties, and this is how small the difference is indicated by curves like this, than the normal one, and that was the reason for paralysis. And there are lots of these. I mean, every channel has mutations, and what we basically did was to go and catalog them. And so I don't have a lot of time, and I'm sure you don't have a lot of interest or patience for this, but let me just sort of show you some curves. So what we basically did is we have tons of plots, and this is an enormous amount of work, I should say. So basically, in order to do this, I just want to give credit where credit is due. So Elaine, who's this fantastic undergraduate, who even stayed for graduate school after putting her through this terrible task, took these things, which is really shows strength of character or something. So what she did was she took curves like this and she digitized them. She digitized them from on the order of 177 different channels from 41 different papers. And she measured the properties. She fit them to simpler models so that we could simply characterize them, and then started plotting the distribution of parameters, how the distribution of parameters changed in different organisms. And this is, it doesn't really matter what the curves are. This is humans. This is different parameters characterizing activation curves in humans. This is inactivation curves in humans, rats. And the different colors correspond to the difference of the 9 types of the channels. And this is inactivation curves from the channels. And so we had all of this data. And the nice thing about this data, this is, I would assert, is exactly like what I was showing you with the fungi and with the whales, what we could have done with the whales had we done it, except that this is on a molecular system. And you then can go in and ask why are the properties set to where they are. And although I don't have time to tell you this, we were able to do one calculation, which I'm not going to show you because it doesn't really matter, actually. And the calculation basically refers to this solid line here. And this solid line basically is the result of a calculation which really has no freedom in it. That is, the curve only depends on the equilibrium potentials of sodium and potassium. And what this curve delineates is that on this side of the line, on the side of the line where all the dots are, it is possible for these channels to produce action potentials. And on the other side of the line, it's not. So this is actually a constraint. And what you can see is that the curve, that the dots go right up to the line. This is humans, and this is rats. The dots go right up to the line. Actually, the ones that are slightly on the other side of the line are mutants. And we were then able to basically, using these types of calculations, which were basically calculations about the physics of the channels, try to understand what differences in the property of action potentials that are produced arise for different places that you are on the right side of this line. So it turns out that, for example, these guys have higher voltage thresholds, higher potential voltage thresholds than those guys. And so we at least learned something about the constraints that exist in the system. So we also were able to show that this same line bounds the inactivation curves, and that the inactivation curves should all be on the other side of the line, that if they're not on the other side of the line, the resting potential loses its uniqueness. So thereby providing something from a calculation with the model of the developmental constraints. Now, this starts to get at what seems to be a relevant issue. That is, there are actually constraints on the way that things work. But the question is, why are there so many channels? And so, just to show you one plot, and I apologize for this, but this is more flavor than anything, is that we were able to do the following thing. So if we divided the channels into those expressed in muscle and those expressed in nerve, so this is a plot of some inactivation property as a function of some activation property. And the red dots are all the data from channels expressed in muscle. The black dots are five of the channels expressed in nerve. And the green and the blue dots are two of the other channels that are expressed in nerve. And what you see is that it at least groups into four different logically distinct groups. And the question then is why? What is the physics of this? And if we had more time or if you had more interest, then I could, I guess you haven't expressed that you don't have interest, those of you who haven't left. So maybe you do. But I can't imagine, I don't know how interesting this is, but we are interested in this. What you can show is that the distance, the perpendicular distance from the line is a measure of the highest voltage threshold that you can have. And so these guys all share the same maximum voltage threshold. The blue dots, which are from this channel NAV1.8, has a higher voltage threshold, and the green dots actually have such a low voltage threshold that thermal fluctuations would trigger action potentials if they were used for that. So we were able to argue from this that, you know, really from a calculation, that the green dots can never be used to produce action potentials, and indeed there was a recent paper to that effect, which was experimental. There were two different groups here. These groups we were able to try to... So the question on these, what is the difference between the groupings? These different groupings, and it turns out that these different groupings reflected different values of the potassium equilibrium potential, and et cetera. So this is the flavor of the sorts of things that we are trying to do. And so so what I've sort of summarized in this part of the talk is at least an explicit demonstration, really, of the constraints that exist on channel evolution in some of the groupings. And I should say that the groupings are actually consistent with phylogenies, except that there's physics in them. So, I mean, I guess you might be bored to death by this, except I would make one statement, that these are voltages that are being plotted. And it turns out that the green dots, which are the ones which are the most different than the others, because the green dots can't be used to produce action potentials, correspond to the channel which is the farthest on the evolutionary tree from all of the other channels. And just in case you think that I'm being insincere, let me quickly go back and just point out to you a very... irrelevant feature, so sorry about this. Should have put it here, but from the other one here, let's see, I think this one is best. So notice actually, you see this is the tree, and NAV1.9 is the furthest from the other groups of channels. And it indeed shows up in the physiology as it should. Now, of course, we weren't able to differentiate all of the channels from each other, but that's because we don't have complete characterizations of the physics of the channels. So now let me just conclude with questions. So the real question is, and this is where we're going next with this, is to connect this to sequences. I mean, because, of course, these I've told you about the difference in the functional properties, but this can be directly connected to sequences. And the question is, really, how do these excitability constraints translate into constraints on the way that letters evolve? And, indeed, what are the sequence changes leading to such differences? And what I'm really interested in is, and I don't really understand how to say this, but, you know, models of evolution of sequence at the moment, as I said at the very beginning of my talk, have no physics in them. And that what you do is you say, well, here's a set of letters, and you change them all with some set of rules, some set of probabilities, which may or may not depend on the letters that are around a particular letter. But in reality, it's this thing which does something. right? And there are, and as you know from any electronic device that you have, there are constraints on what you can do in the electronic device. And what I'm sort of after is trying to ask, is there a way to ask questions about evolution which thinks about the physics of the thing? And this, to me, still seems to be, even after this talk, it still seems to me to be a reasonable way to go about this because of the strong connection that there is. So now, why are there so many sodium channels? So we've at least gotten it down to four sets. So other sets require other selective pressures, which are interesting, would be interesting to explore. And then there's, of course, the entire evolution thing, which this ignores. So it turns out that in invertebrates, there are only five voltage-gated sodium channels. It's of interest to try to understand how that happened, and then again about potassium and calcium channels. And I say at the bottom, we plan on employing a combination of sequence comparisons, models of evolution, and physiological information to try to piece together models of what's going on. And I think with that, I don't really have anything else to say. It's wishful thinking, perhaps, but there it is. I didn't promise you results. Well, that's certainly part. Okay, so the way that mutations occur is a part of the story, which I don't disagree is important. What I mean by the physics is that if you think about these little holes, which are like little transistors, which open and close, and you know, if you were going to describe, maybe let me actually say it this way, and maybe this is the way I should have introduced this talk. This would have probably made it better. Is imagine that you were going to take a list of all transistors that have been made from the 1940s to the present. So you could either sort of talk about the little pieces of the transistor or little circuits, or you could talk about how they actually worked. And I would argue that if you want to think about the change, then you know, talking about the PN junctions and the changes that have happened in doping, may be interesting. But that's not really the physics. I mean, that's, of course, it's related to the physics, but that's not really the big picture of what's going on. And if you, it just strikes me that if you want to think about the sorts of broad questions that I've tried to ask, namely, how are structures tuned? You know, what's actually happening? How does novelty arise in a way that's actually connected to something? You know, your eye develop. I mean, developed what actually happened, that what I mean by physics is device properties. Maybe that's a short answer. But I agree that sort of meiosis and recombination and the way that variation and sequence is produced is important. And that's, of course, well considered and people think hard about that in the context of population genetics. But it's a little different than how things work.
So you sort of skipped over a slide about the nonlinear dynamics.
Yeah. That's right. So I mean, so sodium channels are essentially the element, the dynamical element, which leads to excitability in nerve propagation. And so as you know, in the dynamical systems world, people sort of invent the simplest possible models they can of excitable elements and study those, which is fine. Except that now I tell you that you have 9 or 10, depending on how you want to count, excitable elements inside of your body, which are almost identical, but they're all slightly different. And why would you ever want that, given that that's really their only role? And it really is their only role, at least for many of them.
For a small change in the dynamics of all those things can lead to a big change.
Yeah, that's right. And the question is really, and so, you know, you might ask from the point of view of nonlinear dynamics, if you want to talk about it this way, you might ask, so what would be a good answer to the question of why do you have 9 sodium channels? Well, it seems that there are 2 possible answers. One is that the reason is it's entirely accidental. That is, it has nothing to do with anything. It just happened that somehow you got this extra one and you haven't gotten rid of it yet. That's possible. That's entirely possible, but that would be a good answer. The other possibility is there may be different bifurcation diagrams associated with the different channels, which are important for functional reasons.
Are there bifurcation lines between those simple things?
That's what we're searching for. And the lines that I presented you were examples of the simplest sorts of bifurcation lines you can write down. But there are clearly more complicated ones. And the thought is that if you could work this out, and I should say, for various technical reasons that I'm happy to discuss with anyone who actually cares, it's not clear that it's going to be possible to carry this research program on out. At least, if I were willing to become an ion channel physiologist, and somebody were willing to fund me to basically start studying the electrophysiology of all known ion channels for 15 or 20 years, which is what it would take. I think it might be possible to pull this off. But it's not clear that given...
Team.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Hydration energy is different. They bind the water different. And my understanding was in an ion channel, the most potential way for the barrier involves shedding the water.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So I guess what I'm interested about these different ion channels, how conservative amino acid sequences.
Right.
There are subtle changes that make the local
right.
environment that change that barrier, and that's an exponent. So that's why it's nonlinear. So what's the
conservative? Well, okay, so you're talking about a specific property, which is not the voltage gating of them opening and closing, which is what I've more emphasized, although yours is equally important, which is the mechanism for letting through only one and not the other.
And the potential relationships.
Okay, so for sodium, so I'll give you just a sort of hand-waving answer. So sodium is smaller than potassium. So you can understand maybe why the sodium channel might not let through potassium. You just make a hole which is too small. But the big mystery that existed for a long time was, well, how can you make a potassium channel, right, filter, which, and it turns out that the potassium channels let through 10,000 times as much potassium as sodium. I mean, it's just ridiculous, even though sodium is smaller. And the answer is exactly as you said. So it was discovered by Rod MacKinnon, who won the Nobel Prize for this discovery 2 years ago, who basically crystallized the protein and saw what it looked like. It's exactly as you said. It has to do with hydration, and it has to do with there's a little part of the channel, or the potassium channel, which has, well, this is the story. I don't know if this is true, but this is the story. It has exactly the right size so that the potassium ion feels like it's still in water, but the poor sodium ion is jumping around, and there's this exponential barrier that you alluded to that basically causes there to be a big difference. Now, that part of the sequence is fairly well conserved. The sequences are 2,000 amino acids long, and about 10 of them correspond to what you're talking about. Okay. And those are conserved. Now, there's a very interesting question, which I think is very important, which if I were an ion channel physiologist is what I would start to do, is you could ask, how many amino acids do you have to change to turn a potassium channel into a sodium channel or a calcium channel into a... So, and this is clearly very important. There's no question. This is very important because their sequences are close. They're close enough. They have the same general structure. You could imagine swapping parts. I mean, there's presumably a very rich history, an interesting history of this. And I guess what I like about this set of examples when I'm in a good mood is that there's electrophysiology, which is good. It's voltages. And you all know you can measure voltages. This is something that is the experiments on this. I mean, if you want to compare this to other things of biology are basically as good as it gets, number one. And number two, there's all of this diversity, but you're just talking about opening and closing a hole. So you should be able to think about this. And that's what I like. But there are also lots of things I don't like that I can talk about offline.
No, that's not known.
On the other hand, there is a huge historical. On the other hand, ion channel. So basically, these channels were hypothesized to exist by Hodgkin and Huxley in the 1950s when they figured out basically how signals propagate in nerves. Since the 70s, people have known what the channels were, and they've been basically mutating them one by one, checking what do I have to do to mess it up. Right. So, and because you can do these experiments that I showed you, which really have a lot of numbers on them, which are very reproducible numbers, because they're measurements of currents as a function of time, which is if they're done properly and you don't have leaks or things like this, which are reproducible. There's a lot of information on that sort of thing. So the genotype to phenotype map is not perfect, but I would assert, and I would welcome anyone to disagree with this because I would like to know another example. I would assert I don't know of another example, except perhaps hemoglobin, which is the other example that I didn't talk about, where the genotype to phenotype map is as well understood. The problem with hemoglobin, and the reason that I chose to talk about this instead of hemoglobin, where we basically tried to do similar things, is that hemoglobin doesn't do very much comparatively. I mean, right, the role of hemoglobin is to increase the oxygen saturation in the blood. So as you probably all know, we're all standing here breathing, right? And if we didn't have hemoglobin, then we would have 1/30th the oxygen, the concentration of oxygen in our blood would drop by a factor of 30. I think it's actually maybe more than 36. Maybe I'm missing the number, but a significant factor. And the point is, I don't know why I thought number 30. And hemoglobin increases this. That's its role. And it's the first protein to have been crystallized. And for that reason, it has the same sort of history as ion channels. There's really a lot known about its physiology. But anyway, what I'm trying to get at is really to ask the question. This was the topic of the talk. Yeah. How do you...
So the beginning of your complaint was that a lot of the
No, the answer is the sort of argument that I didn't say about biology. I want to make sure I'm being very clear. These types of arguments, which I made two of, I said were just so. So biology is a different subject. I wasn't complaining about biology. I was complaining about.
Yeah. All seem to come out as just so stories with numbers to them. And I'm just wondering, conceptually, are you going to be able to get around?
I mean, I think the answer to the just so story is to understand the evolutionary history.
But isn't that just a just so story as well?
I guess my attitude about this. Your question and point is well taken. On the other hand, I guess my answer to the thing is the role of sort of simple theory in science is to make models predictable, you know, models which can be compared against data. And, you know, the model that a whale flipper, right, a humpback whale flipper has bumps on it because it optimizes, the aerodynamic maneuverability, I think has something to it. I mean, I believe it as a thing. On the other hand, I think it's sort of problematic in that we don't know how whale flippers develop. And it's sort of hard to test. We don't know why the other whales don't have those flippers. Whereas I think that, you know, the advantage of much more data and connection to sequence is that you should be able to make more detailed models of this sort of thing, which are less amenable to criticism, although you're probably right that any model would be amenable to criticism. But I suspect that there are things that happen in evolution which are phenomenological things, which one could actually uncover if one knew more about what was happening. That would be maybe the hope. I mean, what is the mechanism, for example, for evolving a complex thing? You know, does it happen really by one, changing the amino acids? I mean, that sounds sort of unlikely.
So it sort of goes back to the point of if you replay it all, would we end up where we are now, or is it going to be completely different?
Well, it would probably be, but even, you know, would the emergence of complexity occur at the same rate, I think would be it. And what determines that rate?
I think we're going to end on that question, and people can come and drill a little bit more afterwards. Let's thank the speaker.